Hi, this is your host, Gareth Rice, and you're listening to Canadiana Suite on UMFM 101.5 radio station. This is a radio program primarily dedicated to highlighting the works of the many talented Canadian jazz artists on the scene today. We'll be having Nick McLean on the show to talk about his new solo piano record, Can You Hear Me?, which releases on October 31st. McLean is a multi-award-winning Toronto jazz piano player and leader of both Nick McLean Quartet and the electro jazz group Snaggle. Their albums have won multiple awards, and they have toured all across Canada, taking inspiration from the likes of 60s-era Herbie Hancock, all the way to 70s-era Miles Davis and Weather Report, to name a few. Before the interview, we'll be checking out a tune from the Nick McLean Quartet record, Rites of Ascension, which was released in 2017. This is the Hard Bop original, Nation's Unrest, A Tribal Conflict, featuring solos from McLean and acclaimed trumpeter Brownman Ali, who is a frequent collaborator on many of McLean's musical projects.
The important thing is that we grow. And the only way we can grow is to have a mind that's open enough to be able to experience situations as they are. Take whatever situation you have and make something constructive happen with it.
Thank you.
have the ability to turn challenge into inspiration.
Joining me is Nick McLean, a jazz piano player based in Toronto and bandleader of the Nick McLean Quartet and Snaggle. He's got a new solo piano record, Can You Hear Me, which releases on October 31st, which is pretty spooky. How are you doing, Nick?
I'm doing pretty good, thanks. Thanks so much for having me, Gareth.
Yeah, no problem. So I guess we'll just go straight to the point. What was the kind of the process behind your new solo piano record that you're releasing?
So this record, the process was pretty intense and pretty fluid over the course of the its production. So I started out with a whole lot of solo material that I had composed and had pretty fleshed out, and then was, you know, internalizing and then starting to improvise around. And my producer, Brown Man Ali, the acclaimed trumpet player, and I were looking at this material, and it was too much for a single record. So we decided to just try a bunch of things in the studio while we were recording. So Brown would, in the control room, he would throw something at me and then I'd improvise around that. So like a great example, he came down with a page just with a bunch of seemingly random chords written on it. And he put that in front of me and said, okay, improvise something. I found out like just before we hit record, because I was, you know, playing around with them, that these were actually loosely based on the Charles Mingus classic Goodbye Pork Pie Hat.
Yeah.
But so an entirely spontaneous arrangement based on those changes was recorded and is now featured on the album. And another one, Brown gave me four chords and had me listen to 45 seconds of a track I'd never heard before. And this was a Lauryn Hill recording off of The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill. And so he said, okay, there are your four chords. There's your inspiration. Go. And so that turned into a recording as well. So there's a lot of like worked out compositions that have been really crafted and really honed and played with, but there's also a lot of really spontaneous moments and like real exploration on this album as well. And a lot of the influences that I was really digging into and listening up to the recordings were cats like Bill Evans, Brad Meldow, and Keith Jarrett. So it has a lot of those kind of introspective, ponderous flavors on the album. But yeah, that's essentially how it came about.
Yeah, it's got to be really freeing as an artist just to have like someone like give you just essentially nothing you haven't seen before, and you just kind of riff on that, and you can
Absolutely.
Just kind of get out of the zone of, oh, I know this chord progression, or I know how this is going to go. Let me try something different.
Yeah. And so Brownman and I have been working together for, it's got to be coming up on 8 years now. And so we have a really strong musical relationship together. And you know, it's been founded on a great deal of trust and such over the years. So he knows me really well. So he knows how to kind of bring the best version of myself out, and I know him really well, so I really trust his musical judgment. And so like it's a solo record in that on just about the entire thing it's all solo piano, but I mean in reality this is really a duo record, because there's so much give and take between me and Brown, and so much you know, of him planting a seed and then me just trying to run with that seed and see where it goes.
Yeah, like it's kind of a back and forth. You kind of give and take, and then you kind of build on that.
Absolutely, yeah. And in some ways, it's unfortunate that people won't hear the other side of the duo quite as much, because it's had such a profound effect on the album. Though on a couple of the tracks, we included snippets of Brown's instructions to me before we included, just so people can see, oh, okay, here were the instructions and here's the track that resulted from that.
Yeah, like a bit of context to lead into the thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. When I was checking out the solo piano concert you were talking about, I was like listening to your context behind like the originals that you wrote, and like they're kind of based on like social issues or how you'd like interpret like a thing that happened. Like for example, there was that one, like there was a person who was like a black person who was talking to the Ku Klux Klan and he was trying to make friends
Right,
with them.
Daryl Davis.
Daryl Davis, yeah. And then it actually worked. Like people actually came up to his, like his viewpoint and they stopped being so discriminatory. So I was kind of wondering like what your thought process is when you're creating originals. How do you convey that, like to put that to the music?
So, I mean, I guess first of all, I try and stay away from the political layer of discourse. Because I mean, as I'm sure we're all well aware, that layer is fraught with all kinds of, dissonance and fighting and people not listening to the other person and all that. And so I try hard to try and attack things from a more philosophical layer. Like let's get rid of the talking points, get rid of all that. Let's deal with the principles behind things. And so like with the case of Daryl Davis, like I was really blown away by this cat because here's someone who believes so fully in the importance of confronting bad ideas on their own merits that he's willing to, like step into a room with someone who thinks he's a lesser person just because of the color of his skin. And he's willing to stand his ground, but not in a combative way, but in a let's try and understand this. And it's amazing because he has just hundreds of KKK robes that people have given him because after these conversations and after they've built this relationship with this man, they're like, okay, I can't square the reality of this with the things that this organization believes. And I can't be a part of that anymore. And so I when it comes to representing that in music, I try and look at, well, what are the characteristics of a situation like that or a conversation with that? Because like something like the KKK, those beliefs are pretty crazy. And in order to hold them, there's got to be, at least to my mind, there's got to be some really firm ignoring of reality. In order to hold those beliefs. So there's got to be some real cognitive dissonance and some real leaps of logic that are happening. So I just tried to imagine to myself, what on earth does like a rational conversation with an individual like that look like? And so what resulted was like a tune that is incredibly angular and weaves around in kind of like a monkish kind of way where it's really off the wall. Because I mean, I'm just imagining Daryl Davis sitting there like, okay, I have to try and bring some reasonability, some rationality to this like crazy rhetoric. How do I soften all of these edges? How do I bring us back to the truth? Or some kind of reasonable perspective. So that's kind of what I tried to represent in that particular tune.
Yeah, I guess you'd have to like kind of structure it in the tune itself. Because if you're dealing with like a racist viewpoint, you'd be like up here. And if you're trying to level them down here, then you can like really do that in terms of you can really shape that in the tune. And like you
Yeah,
said,
and there's so many like assumptions and stuff that you've got to kind of like gently go, okay, that I don't think that's true, and here's why. So I mean, yeah, it's and I've watched interviews of Daryl talking about some of his like initial conversations and just how tense they were and how like contentious and how like just how on edge everyone was. So I tried to kind of put that into the tune.
nice. Yeah, going off of that, were there any like ways that you structured the solo piano arrangements? Like, were you thinking of like certain techniques or certain like people that you wanted to bring into certain tunes that you were thinking of?
Yeah, sometimes. It's so generally speaking, the way that I structure the original compositions is, and this isn't true with all of them, but for a lot of them, I wrote out every single note, except for the improvised solo, and I learned it exactly as is. And then as I internalized that, I started to let go of the arrangement that was on the page. So that way, there's new techniques under my fingers that I wouldn't necessarily have had the facility to improvise around that I now can do that a little bit more. And I was inspired by so years ago, Wayne Shorter's quartet was performing in Toronto, and there was a workshop with Brian Blade, Danilo Perez, and John Patitucci, and they're describing some of the methodologies of that band, and they described something very similar to that process. Like Wayne would come to them with like this fully worked out composition, and they'd, you know, they'd play it and they'd learn it, and you know, after it was done, all the band members would say, "Oh, Wayne, this is such a great tune. This is so beautiful. I'm so glad we've learned this." And Wayne would, you know, he'd say, "Oh, that was the start. We're not done yet. Now we've learned it. Now we let go of the arrangement and we improvise around those structures and we let that be a vehicle for exploration." So I wanted to take that kind of approach. And so there's a lot of Bill Evans that I'd been doing some listening to, like the Spartacus Love Theme Nardus medley that's on there. That's kind of a tribute to his version of that appears on the Solo Sessions Volume 1. But then some of the originals, like Circle of Influence, to me, I'm trying to take some sounds from Keith Jarrett a little bit more. Like I find a lot of his solo piano playing has a very pure kind of sound to it. And so I'm trying to take some of those influences and inject them in there, both in the writing and in the improvisation a little bit as well. That's kind of the process.
Yeah, you kind of take things from different people and you just kind of meld it into your own sound.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And you kind of just develop it as you go along. I guess we can pivot to your 2017 album you did with the Nick McLean Quartet, The Rites of Ascension. So I was listening to it and it kind of sounds like it kind of conveys the spirit of Herbie Hancock's 1960s Blue Note recordings, because like you have Cantaloupe Island. You have the drifting, one finger snap, oh, that's Empyrean Isles. And like, but I've also noticed that you kind of slightly like tweaked the arrangements. Like, for example, the Cantaloupe Island, there was like a chromatic ascension like halfway through, and then there was like a sus4 chord. So I was kind of wondering, like, how was that kind of just fun to like play around with that and make it your own?
Yeah, it's well. I mean, in a lot of ways, I think that's necessary, because I mean, it to me, art is about evolution, and I mean, there's and that's not to disparage artists who aren't doing that, because you know, there's a lot of really great, talented recording cats who are playing Dixieland or big band swing or anything like that. But for me personally, art should be looking forward, because you know, Herbie's already done Maiden Voyage and Empyrean Isle, so we don't, at least I don't need to replicate that. I definitely want to take influences from that, because I mean, it's those recordings are incredible, and are certainly a big influence on what I do with that group. So that group is all about kind of exploring that post-bop 1960s sound with that quartet that Herbie had with Freddie Hubbard. But you know, looking forwards, taking the influences and doing something with them. So with that record, we started with three Herbie Hancock tunes with kind of our own spin on them. But then it moves to originals, taking with the idea that we're presenting the source material to our audience. And then saying, okay, here's what we've done with the source material, because it's always I always find it cool whenever people take source material and then inject themselves into it and come to something entirely different, because you can have two artists that are influenced by the same things that'll come to different conclusions based on those influences, and that to me is really interesting and exciting.
Yeah, exactly. Because there's so many recordings in jazz where they take inspiration from something else or they completely rework it, like John Coltrane's My Favorite Things, or like, I guess, like Bill Evans on Suicide Is Painless.
Yeah,
Yeah.
absolutely.
And it's just like, you know that it's them, like they did that thing. And it's like, oh, I can listen to this and this. Oh, this is hip. I'm going to go back to the original record and like, I'm going to check out who did this thing and this thing. Because like the original thing is always there, but you can always check out the other thing.
Absolutely.
Or like Brad Mehldau, definitely. You've also talked about your album art, like you kind of want to move away from the common jazz musicians stare seriously in a group kind of mentality. So can you kind of explain the process behind your album art for Rites of Ascension? Also, can you hear me?
Sure. Yeah, it's so yeah, it's I'm not quite as big a fan of the, just picture on the front and some text. And it works for a lot of folks and it looks great, but it's not really me. And like I was always I'm a huge science fiction fan, and I've always been a real fan of like book covers with really interesting kind of out of this world designs. And actually this is perfect for the record label that I'm signed to, Brown Man's record label, Brown to Source Records, because the only rule about any of the releases that go on the record label is the album art has to be just a little bit science fiction. Now, because I love science fiction, I push it to a little bit more than just a little bit science fiction. But so like for Snaggle's album art for the first release we did for the record label, it's this really alien-looking tiger that's crash-landed on a planet and is walking towards the viewer with these glowing footprints in the background. For Nick McLean Quartet, we wanted to, like, we had the challenge of trying to inject some of those elements in there while also making it look like a serious jazz album cover. Like there were a lot of brainstorming ideas that we tried and just looked so silly and like, okay, if we stick this on the front, it's gonna be super sci-fi, but no one's gonna take this seriously as a jazz record. So it took some brainstorming before we found the image of, okay, Nick kind of suspended above the piano in this post-apocalyptic kind of scene, and it works. It's got those elements, but it also looks like a serious album. And so then for this one, this album, so Can You Hear Me, is suffused with all kinds of thoughts and principles having to do with communication. And like these were a lot of themes that I wanted to explore with this material. And actually, originally the material was meant to be like a super deep exploration on freedom of speech. But I decided I wanted to take it a little bit deeper, kind of to a more principled place of, okay, well, how do we communicate? How do we get along as people, as a society? And given how a lot of the tracks came about, like due to a deep level of communication between Brown, my producer, and myself, to create these really spontaneous and exploratory things, that was kind of the theme that I settled on. So to me, the idea, so for people who haven't seen the album art, it's a picture of me standing on an alien world with this giant cable that's all purple and electrified, plugged into a grand piano, hooked up to a giant satellite array, with the idea that I'm about to like perform a concert beamed out into the cosmos. And so I thought the image was a really powerful one. And we got a so what we do with all of our album art is we kind of mock up a really rough version of it using my terrible Photoshop skills, and then we get a real deal artist to execute the vision. And we got a really fantastic graphic artist named Neil Padeloy, based here in Toronto, to do that for us. I think he's a recent OCAD graduate, and he's doing some really phenomenal work.
Yeah, the Snaggle art in particular, like it really grabbed me, like the way that the orange and like the all hues really got together. Yeah, I really liked it. Yeah, you were talking about Brontosaurus Records, and the thing about that is that it gives 100% of the profits to the musicians. So how has that partnership helped your journey as a musician?
Brontosaurus Records has been game-changing for me. So it's as you mentioned, it's a bit of an unconventional label, 'cause in the traditional label format, the label puts down a bunch of money for an artist to record, and but then they also retain a certain level of ownership over the recordings, and they retain a certain percentage of the record sales and all that kind of stuff. And so Brontosaurus Records in many ways is set up almost like a mentoring kind of thing. Like Brown Man has taught me so much about making records, about composing music, about recording music, and the whole process. So this is my fourth release with Brown Source Records, three full-length albums and a holiday single. And he is so effective at pulling the best possible performance, presenting and as well as presenting those performances in the best possible way so that audiences coming to it for the first time get a really rich listening experience. Like really get a solid performance out of their artist, but also are able to delve deeper and look into some detailed liner notes and see, okay, how was this recorded? How did this come about? And so then the record label is set up specifically so that all the proceeds go back to the artists, because really, like, the record label's mandate is to catalyze the creation of new jazz art. That's all the label cares about. It's not about turning a profit. It's about how do we get more modern jazz art into the world. And album sales today, as I'm sure you well know, like the profits that artists make from album sales is next to nothing these days. Like unless you're signed to a big label and are selling millions upon millions of discs, you're making very little, especially today in the advent of Spotify, Apple Music, you know, where you're getting paid like 0.00001 of a penny per stream. Like it's I was looking at my total sales for online streaming for like the last couple years from the Nick McLean Quartet release, and it's something depressing like $30 or something, just because I mean this is yeah it's I mean it's I love these streaming platforms as a customer because I have access to all this music that I can listen to, and that's fantastic. As an artist, it's terrible. So having a record label that doesn't touch any of that and just, you know, it's all going back to the artist, that helps a lot, because with a lot of these records, a lot of people aren't turning a profit on it. A lot of people aren't even breaking even on their records. Now, I still think it's important to do. Like, I'm not going to stop making records if I don't make a profit, because for me, it's about more than that. It's about making a snapshot of this point in time. This is who I was as an artist. This is what I sounded like. And, you know, down the road when I'm old and on my deathbed, that's going to be my legacy. That's going to be what I leave behind after I'm gone. This is who I was. This is who I was as a player. These are some of the things that I had to say as a player, both musically and philosophically. So for me, it's important. I think it's important for, you know, the cultural makeup of the country for artists to be producing this kind of stuff, even if it's not commercially wildly successful. But yeah, the way Brontosaurus is set up really helps catalyze that and really supports that process.
Yeah, I definitely agree with everything you just said. Like it's, yeah, like,
Yeah.
yep.
Well, and for anyone listening, like if anyone's got an independent artist that they really dig and they really want to support, buy their record at their shows. That's the best way to support them. Like the vast majority of the money that I make from album sales comes at shows, selling physical discs. And at Brontosaurus specifically, physical discs are also where you're going to get the deepest experience, because that's where all the liner notes and stuff are kept. And on the record label, there's a mandate, extensive liner notes, because, you know, not everyone's interested, but for those who are, for those who want to dig in and learn more about the people behind the music, we want that information to be there. And, you know, on Spotify, on iTunes, there's no place to look that stuff up. It's just here's the track, here's the artist, that's it. And I think that's terrible, because, you know, it's important to know about the people behind the music, because it's, you know, we're not jukeboxes.
Yeah, one thing about a consumer of Spotify that I really hate is that it never really tells you who's on the record, because
Yeah.
it's so annoying. Because you're, or like, what inspired this record? Like, what were you saying with the liner notes? It's like, you don't know any of that stuff unless you have to look it up for yourself, which just makes it an
Absolutely.
inconvenience. So it's just
Yeah,
like,
I completely agree with that. I very much wish that Spotify would list, all the artists that are on the track, even if they're just a guest, because, it's some of us want to know that information. I also love it. It doesn't happen super often, but I love it whenever radio plays a track and they say, okay, this is a track by such and such and featured solos by this person and this person. Because, if you just heard a track and there was a really killing solo, you want to know who that is. Because, you want to go and check them out later. So it's nice when that information is presented.
Definitely, yeah. How did the Toronto jazz scene influence like your creative ideas, like collaborations with other musicians?
Well, I mean, Toronto has a really rich jazz scene. There's a lot of fantastic players, and my collaborations with those players have definitely influenced different directions that I've taken my music. I mean, like prior to performing with some cats, Brown Man Ali in particular, I had virtually no immersion in any kind of real deal Latin jazz. But in the last couple years, I've had the opportunity to play with some really fantastic Latin jazz musicians like Joaquin Geraldo Nunez, Paco, oh no, I'm forgetting Paco's last name, a brilliant bass player in Toronto named Paco. And like playing with these musicians has really given me a chance to immerse myself in a style of music that, normally you'd have to go to Cuba or Brazil to get like the real deal stuff. So I'm really blessed to be in a city that has such a wide cross-section of musicians from such a diverse background of music. So I'm able to kind of get a really authentic experience from some of these, and I can take that and I can use it in.
Yeah, like there's so many like hip people in Toronto that like there's so many great records you can check out.
Yeah, and one of the things that's been really interesting in the, after this pandemic, Brown's been starting a weekly jam session, and we've been meeting a whole bunch of really young cats that we didn't know at all, who are, some of them are still going through Humber, and they're killers. They're absolute killers. Like my group Nick McLean Quartet's going to be playing a show in a couple weeks. But with a young drummer named Matteo Mancuso, who is absolutely fantastic, yeah, sounds really killer. And there are other cats that we've been playing with, like Ben Duff on the bass, Jacob Wutsky on drums. Young cats, fresh out of Humber or still going in, and so it's been really wonderful to like meet all these young, inspiring players. I mean, this was Miles Davis's thing, in a lot of ways. He liked to play with young players because they kept him young. It kept him fresh, and because if you're only playing with the cats that you came up with, and are at your level, then you're only getting one slice of the scene. But if you play with a wide range of cats, then you're going to be exposed to a lot more things, and you're going to be much more like well-rounded as a musician, because it's going to push you in different directions.
Exactly, because you can hear like different influences from different people. Like, oh, say, I don't know, Bob listens to Snarky Puppy, like Emily listens to like Brett Garland, and like I don't know, like Harry listens to Freddie Hubbard. It's like,
Yeah.
oh, okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, or even like beyond jazz, like
Yeah, it
this
definitely.
cat's checking out Mos Def, this cat's checking out Kendrick Lamar or Ruben Blades or the Fort Apache Band. Like it's a great way of cross-pollinating genres and taking influences from different places and often unexpected places that you just never think to check out on your own.
Yeah, like, and I guess in terms of genre, you can like modify jazz or like any genre and kind of like build them into your own thing. 'Cause I also noticed that you put in a lot of like samples into your records and you kind of like melded them into like the tunes. So that was pretty sick.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and that's kind of more of a hip hop thing. You don't tend to see that a whole lot in jazz records. And so that was something that Brown Man suggested that we do in the Nick McLean Quartet record, and then we've done it a bit more in the solo piano record. And yeah, I love it. It's especially in instrumental music that is super abstract, and you don't have a singer to like literally tell the story of the tune. It's nice to have little snippets here and there just to give an extra little context, an extra little bit of here's the flavor of what's being explored here.
Yeah, I guess you also describe yourself as a synthesis. So how does that kind of factor into your work with the Snaggle and Nick McLean Quartet?
Yeah, so it's with Nick McLean Quartet and the solo piano stuff, it doesn't factor in a great deal. But with Snaggle, it's a huge part of that because I'm not playing much of piano in there. I've got an entirely different sound palette, and like anyone who's seen my full setup synthesizer rig, it's pretty serious. There's a double tier keyboard, MIDI controller on the bottom that's running patches through Main Stage 3, a fantastic software that has a wide library of sounds, and I use that a lot for like Rhodes patches, organ patches, and the odd other thing. And then I have a Moog Little Fatty Stage 2 that I first saw. Oh, I'm forgetting his name. I'm sure I'll remember it in a second. It's on the tip of my tongue. Sean Martin, keyboard player who plays with Snarky Puppy a whole bunch. I first saw him do it, and I just love the sound of that board. It's just got such a joyful and like sonorous quality to it. And so I love using it as kind of like a lead synth voice in my setup. But you know, I've incorporated other things into it, like a talk box kind of thing, which allows for like some like almost vocal-like qualities to some of the synth patches, because you can incorporate syllables into the sound, which just gives it a visceral quality that I love. But I've also incorporated a breath controller into the setup, because I don't know about you. Have you ever what do you think of expression pedals like that yeah, for controlling volume? Because I hate them, because I find that the physical feedback that I get from my feet controlling that kind of thing is not flexible enough to make the kind of dynamic changes that I want to make with something like an organ. So I in reading, I discovered about breath controllers, and the only company that I could find that actually still makes them is like this company in the Netherlands that make a fantastic breath controller that's just a USB that'll plug right into your computer. And so I use that for my organ patches, because I can control the dynamic level, you know, at the drop of a hat, just with a change in the velocity of the breath stream. But organ patches are hard to control in that way, because like a lot of organ can be very sustained sometimes. So I had to learn how to circular breathe to do a little bit of that with that. So it's, yeah, it's, I love this kind of work because it gives me an entirely different palette of sounds to use from the piano. And some of it is similar in texture, but some of it is entirely different. Like piano, you can't sustain notes, but on a Moog, you can have a screaming, like energy-filled note that stays there and doesn't decay after that first kind of thing, and puts a little bit of a warble or an expression on it as you manipulate the wheel. So I love that kind of stuff. So I use that. I use that in Snaggle, and I've in the last couple years, I've been working on a sporadic YouTube series called Sum of One that explores those textures a little bit further as well. So yeah, I love that kind of stuff, and as it fits into kind of the electric jazz category.
Yeah, it definitely gives you such a rich palette to choose from.
Absolutely.
Do you have any future projects or gigs that are coming up?
Yeah, it's, well, I mean, this weekend I'm performing with the Brown Man Electric Trio on Halloween, the day that the Can You Hear Me record is coming out. We're doing a Michael Jackson Halloween Thriller tribute. And so every year, Brown Man puts on this show where we play down the entire Michael Jackson Thriller record, interpreted through the lens of electric jazz, like as Miles Davis would do during his 1970s period. So that's going to be a ton of fun. I've got some solo piano stuff booked, though most of the CD release dates for that will likely be in the new year. Because in about a month's time, I'm going to be a father. My wife is very pregnant with our daughter, And so I'm taking a couple of months away from performance just to adjust to what, what life with a child looks like, and getting adjusted to the new rhythm of things. But once we're kind of set, I'm going to be doing some CD releases for the solo piano show, and then I'm going to be turning my attention to the next Nick McLean Quartet record. So we were very fortunate to have secured a grant from the Canada Arts Council to do another national tour of Canada in 2023. So we did one in 2019, where we started in Toronto, we went all the way to the West Coast, Vancouver Island, and back, and played everywhere that we could in between. It was like a month and a half of solid road. It was so much fun. So we're gonna be doing that again in 2023. Right now we're looking at like April, May, and so we want a brand new record to take with us as we go. So 2022 is gonna be all about Nick McLean Quartet's new record.
Yeah, sounds good. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. And for any listeners who want to check out Can You Hear Me, my new double solo album, the album will be avail or the album will be available this October 31st on Bandcamp, Spotify, Apple Music, like pretty much anywhere music is sold online. And will also be available on my website, nicholasmclean.com, or at the record label's website, the record label that the album's coming on, Brontosaurus Records, at brontosaurus.com.
Thanks again to Nick McLean for being on the show. To end off this set, we'll be looking at some tracks from his new solo piano record, Can You Hear Me?, which is out now. What you heard before the interview was Nation's Unrest, a tribal conflict by the Nick McLean Quartet off their 2017 record, Rites of Ascension. This is a standard, Things Aren't What They Used to Be. The original Rational Discourse, inspired by the Black activist and musician Daryl Davis, and the Afro-Cuban original Estratagema, featuring Browman Ali. This has been Canadiana Suite on UMFM 101.5 radio station, and it's been a pleasure. Till next time.
Thank you. the time to sit down and talk with your adversaries. It's when the talking ceases, the ground becomes fertile for violence. But guess what? They may have been harmless and we were just ignorant. Century, man. We are living in space age times, but there's still too many of us thinking with Stone Age minds. Thank you.